In the new book, The Boy Who Played with Fusion, Extreme Science, Extreme Parenting, and How to Make a Star, science journalist Tom Clines explores child prodigy Taylor Wilson. By the age of 9, Wilson had mastered the science of rocket propulsion. At 11, his grandmother's cancer diagnosis drove him to investigate new ways to produce medical isotopes. By 14, he had built a 500 million degree reactor and become the youngest person in history to achieve nuclear fusion. Clines chronicles Taylor Wilson's extraordinary journey from his Arkansas home, where his non-scientist parents fully supported his intellectual passions, to a unique Reno, Nevada public high school just for academic superstars, to the present, when Wilson is winning international science competitions with devices designed to prevent terrorists from shipping radioactive material into the country. Again, the title of the book is The Man Who Played with Fusion, Extreme Science, Extreme Parenting, and How to Make a Star. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Tom Clines to the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, I'm glad to be here, Joe. Thanks for inviting me.
Very nice to have you here. How did you first become aware of Taylor Wilson?
Well, I write about science and the environment for magazines like National Geographic and Popular Science, and I was digging around this whole world of amateur high-energy physics and came across people who were doing things like splitting atoms in their own home-built machines and fusing atomic nuclei, and got really interested in that. It was sort of a secretive community, but they started to open up to me, and I heard along the way about this kid who had just recently become the 32nd person on Earth to achieve a nuclear fusion reaction as an individual outside the major labs. And so said, hey, that sounds interesting. And it started out being a book about Taylor and an article about Taylor, and it turned into something a bit more. It became about his family, this really unusual family and their parenting style, which was really quite different than what most of us would regard as common sense, such as keeping your kid away from things that can kill them.
How much of that is really a chicken and the egg question? I mean, did they react to his genius and develop this parenting style, or do you think that it was because they were so open that allowed him to explore and grow?
It was a chicken and egg thing. It was both. They have no idea where their parenting style came from. They will tell you that they have no idea where Taylor came from, their son, the boy who played with fusion, because they weren't scientists. And they had this super, I guess you would say, this kid that wouldn't take no for an answer. And, would stomp his feet and say, yeah, I want to crane for my 5th birthday, and they'd bring him to a toy store, and he'd say, no, I want a real one. And then his dad would have a friend from a construction company roll up at his birthday party with a real crane, and the kids would get to operate it, and so on. And so they developed this sort of culture of intellectual spoiling in their house that was quite unique, and in terms of talent development, it was quite effective.
What's fascinating in reading the book is that everyone's playing. So here's this kid who's playing with fusion, and yet he is also a kid. I mean, there is a genius aspect to this, but then there's also the fact that at some point, he's 9, 11, 14, 18 years old. He's a kid.
Yeah, he's a surprisingly normal kid. He is. Lots of times we think of these science fair kids as kids that are sitting in the corner with their eyes down, but Taylor's incredibly garrulous and just really switched on and very good at drawing people into his orbit. That's actually quite extraordinary, but he's actually quite normal in other ways, in that he, he has the same sort of crushes and confusions as he's going through his teenage years and has this sort of terrible period of hyper narcissism, I guess you could say. But then again, I mean, yeah, it's bad enough for any teenager, but people were calling him Einstein and they weren't joking.
Right.
He really was an incredibly smart kid.
How do you not believe your own press?
Exactly.
Because you are the kid who can do this stuff. So there is a point, where do you think in the story in his development did he realize that he was special?
I think he realized that almost from the beginning. He was a shy kid up until he was 5 or 6 years old, and then 9/11 happened, and he spontaneously sang "God Bless America" at this rally and ceremony for the victims, and at that point, his shyness kind of disappeared, and it was apparently quite a moving experience. He had this very ethereal soprano, and he became a bit of a performer, and got into building rockets. He mastered the art of rocket science quite early and was building bigger and bigger rockets, and then he was interested in, you know, exploding them. So he's quite a showman, really. He loves to, you know, sort of be the center of attention.
So, I mean, this gets back to an earlier point that you made, but how does he get his hands on the stuff to start building rockets?
Well, here we get into the sort of hyper-indulgent parenting. So this is sort of, I guess you could call it the next step in helicopter parenting,
okay,
where you have, you know, when we think of these helicopter parents, it's this sort of not very nice stereotype of these pushy, over-competitive parents who are, you know, piloting the helicopters, hoovering over their kids' every move and you know, taking them in the directions that the parents want to go. But their style, and a style that talent development experts and child psychologists say is actually quite effective in developing talent in these gifted and talented kids, was to let their own kids have the keys to the helicopters and fly their own helicopters. So the parents get on board with the fuel and you know, everything the kids need, and then they let their kids fly as far and in any direction they want to chase their passions. Now, most kids don't get into something as crazy as radioactive materials, but they decided that if he was going to take this where he wanted to go, they were going to have to give him some room to do that and also keep the family safe.
Tom Kleins is our guest. The name of the book, The Boy Who Played with Fusion. You use the term in the subtitle of the book of his extreme parenting. So what makes it extreme? And it should be noted that he also has a younger brother, Joey. So is that same style in place for him?
Yeah, I think that what Taylor achieved really has as much to do with his own talents as it does with being gifted with parents of the most extraordinary sort, who are willing to go way, 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 way farther than other parents. They weren't super rich. You know, they didn't have a whole lot. They didn't have unlimited resources. They lived in the deep South, but they were willing to do things like, well, when the kids got interested in rocketry, and they would travel to NASA launches, to space shuttle launches. Then they go to the Houston Space Center and things like that.
Right.
When his younger brother Joey got interested in cooking, they went to Santa Fe so they could do a Southwest cooking class, that kind of thing. They were never afraid to take their kids out of school to travel with them. You know, as parents, we get so hung up on things like grades and attendance, and we forget that what really matters is actual learning.
By 14 years old, he had built a reactor and became the youngest person in history to achieve nuclear fusion. So that obviously doesn't happen overnight and isn't just one kid. It does take others. So talk to me a little bit about how that is incubated, if you will, to say, okay, this is what I want to do and this is what I'm going to do.
So the motivation for building a nuclear fusion reactor for Taylor was the death or the impending death of his grandmother when he was 11. And the family had a friend, a nuclear pharmacist, who came over and was checking on Taylor's stash of radioactive materials. This is one of the ways that his parents helped keep him safe, was to get other people involved to check on him and make sure that he was doing it right, so that he wasn't going to, you know, either blow up the house or irradiate everybody. But in any case, they asked the friend, how do people in Africa get a hold of medical isotopes? And these are things that actually need to be shipped from these multi-million dollar cyclotrons. And because they have a short half-life, you know, they need to so that they can get in and do their job and then destroy themselves before they destroy much tissue, other tissue inside the body. But so they need to be shipped very quickly, and they're incredibly expensive. And so the pharmacist, Mr. Boudreaux, said, well, actually, most people in Africa can't get these things. So Taylor had this idea, well, what if there was a better way to do it, a cheaper way to do it? And he had this epiphany. What if you could, instead of using these multi-million dollar cyclotrons and then shipping isotopes around by private jets all around the world, what if you could transmute these elements via nuclear fusion reactions and then put a little reactor that was small enough, safe enough, and cheap enough to be in every hospital on Earth that had electricity? So he got this idea when he was 11. And it was a really interesting scene in that his grandmother had, when she was going through chemotherapy, had given him some of her urine to test. He had asked for it. And she'd also given him bits of tumor that she'd coughed up from her lungs. And this is weird stuff, and Taylor knows it's weird, but he would do things like make the tumors grow in petri dishes, and he'd test the urine with his Geiger counters. He had this idea as he's stirring the urine one day, wow, this looks like the sun. And of course, nuclear fusion is the process that powers the sun and other stars. And he started thinking, I wonder if this could work. And he was 11 then, and by the time he was 14, he had figured out a way to get these nuclear fusion reactions where you're combining atomic nuclei rather than splitting them like we do with power stations. And by the time he was 18, he'd built his isotope machine and taken it to the International Science and Engineering Fair.
Well, part of this story, of course, is his education, and obviously not only the sacrifices that his parents make, which include moving him to places that will make this possible, going cross country to say, okay, you can do this. But it's also about education in an environment, and what do you do when you put a kid, a genius, into a situation where, you know, he's probably a lot smarter than the people who are going to be teaching him.
Yeah, that's where Taylor's parents, Tiffany and Kenneth, ran up against roadblocks. So they'd been very creative about getting him the education that everything he needed for to learn and to conduct his experiments. But by the time he got to eighth grade, the school had given him all it could. He was actually teaching the class. He had first, in seventh grade, got in trouble because they were using outdated textbooks and they'd be talking about the parts of the atom, and he'd say, no, that's wrong. You know, we know more about that now, and atoms actually are composed of other particles, and the subatomic world is more complicated than this textbook's saying. I'm going to put that answer down because it's wrong. And the teacher would call his mom and say, he's failing. He won't put the right answer down. And but he held his ground and ended up teaching the class by the time he was in eighth grade. And then he was cooked. He was going nowhere with his reactor. He had no mentors in anywhere nearby. And he said every day felt like a 100 years sitting through school. And that's kind of one of the biggest tragedies in American education, is that gifted children like Taylor spend a lot of their time waiting. They did a survey of kids, 17,000 gifted kids. And that was when they asked, you know, how would you describe your experience as a gifted child in school in one word? The answer that most of them gave was the word waiting. You know, they were always waiting for other kids to catch up, always waiting for teachers to, you know, get the materials they need. So we're overlooking this incredible mass of people that who don't have the resources in their schools. There are gifted and talented programs in some schools, but they're not widely distributed in this country.
Tom Kleins is our guest. The name of the book, The Boy Who Played with Fusion. How does a kid like this find his way in the world? He's now an adult, and he's able to do these incredible things. So how does he use this knowledge to his benefit, to live a fulfilled life, and also to that of society, which needs much of what needs the knowledge that, that he possesses.
He was extremely lucky in that he, his parents did move him across the country to this Davidson Academy in Reno, Nevada, which is sort of a Hogwarts for geniuses. And he was able to develop and bring mentors into his orbit there and to do what he wanted to do. And he got the support. And it's one of the big myths of gifted education that these kids can make it on their own. They can't. They need support like any other kids. It's another kind of special education, essentially. But Taylor also, when he was 16, 17, getting all this attention, you know, I really worried about how he would use his knowledge, whether he would actually use it for good or end up either losing his head or and ending up, you know, in San Francisco on Telegraph Avenue and wandering around, or whether he might build weapons like and end up falling apart later in life like the guys that built the atomic bomb did.
Right.
But what happened was that he had a series of failures when he was late in his high school career where he didn't win at the International Science Engineering Fair. He had won big the year before and was going to take it all, and he didn't. Somebody else won. And he also had a girlfriend who dumped him and said, I don't like the way you're treating people, Taylor. And she didn't tell him that. He had to find that out through other people. But these led to sort of another epiphany, which was that maybe he needed to humble down and start figuring out how he could help people. And so now he has become, in addition to building his company and doing these isotopes and nuclear security devices, he's become a sort of science educator, and he's become a mentor to other kids who want to do the kinds of things that, that he wants to do. And all the people that were worried about him now say, wow, you know, what a change this kid had. I never thought I'd call him humble, but he is actually quite humble now. Quite an interesting kid, too.
The company, is that what he wants to do, is to grow that company? Is there an overall ambition of a goal of I want to achieve this?
I thought that was what he wanted to do, and he thought that was what he wanted to do. Now I'm not so sure, and I don't think he's so sure. You know, we have this in the news lately. There's been this idea that Silicon Valley has this sort of age bias, where you know young people are the superstars and older people are you know not allowed in the club. But with that bias has come this unrealistic expectation that these tech geniuses are also business geniuses too. And with the exception of a few outliers, really that's just not the case. It's a different skill set. Taylor loves to experiment. He loves to be in the lab. He loves to talk. He loves to communicate. Does he love to grow a business? I'm not so sure he does. I'm not so sure he's cut out for that. You know, maybe he will bring in other people to help him do that at some point, but it remains to be seen. I mean, he's still quite young.
Is he a wealthy man?
He's wealthy for a kid that's 21 years old, and he's wealthy from doing things like winning $150,000 at the science fairs. He's wealthy from things like going around and speaking at nuclear industry conferences and things like that. But he could be quite wealthy because he has venture capitalists. Every time he goes to talk at TED or meet with Peter Thiel, who's one of his mentors, you know, people are glad to throw money at him if he wants it, but he hasn't really made his move to capitalize on that yet, and I wonder when he will and if he will.
Are the parents still very much involved?
His parents are very much involved. They've moved back to Arkansas, to Texarkana. Taylor is still in Reno. His parents are still quite involved in his life, but they also were pretty exhausted by raising Taylor.
I bet.
Yeah, I mean, this was not an easy kid to raise. So I think in some ways they're glad that aspect of their lives is over and that they could concentrate on their youngest son, Joey.
And, I mean, is he a super genius too, or is he like a normal kid?
Joey is a super genius too, but he is more like what we think of as super geniuses. in that Joey is an introvert, and most gifted kids are. About two-thirds to three-quarters turn out to be introverts, especially kids that are interested in the sciences and math and things like that. Now, whereas Taylor was this ultra extrovert, Joey doesn't like to tell the world what he's doing. His mom used to find, when she'd go into the bathroom after he was in the shower, she'd find calculations drawn in the steam on the shower door. That's how Joey sort of communicates with the world. So he wanted no part of what he called the Taylor Show. He never wanted to be famous.
You have the same haircut as Taylor? Taylor has a very interesting hairstyle.
Yeah, Joey has a different hairstyle than Taylor does. Yeah. Joey's just, he's a different kid. And what was good for Taylor educationally turned out to be not so great for Joey, the school for geniuses, where Taylor could be with his intellectual peers. Joey missed his friends back home in Arkansas. I remember that when I was a kid. I was in a gifted and talented program for 1 year. And after that, I begged my parents to let me out and let me go back to my old friends.
And be quote-unquote normal, whatever that is.
Right, right.
So you're writing this book about this kid and about a star, and we should note as we record this, your two kids are here. Your two sons are here.
My two little geniuses.
Right. So, I mean, is there a point where you're writing this book and you're looking at them going, oh, slackers? Or do you think, or do you say, oh, great, these are, you know, these kids will not have that same pressure.
No, they'll never have that same pressure. Taylor actually never had that pressure from his parents. Most gifted kids are autodidacts. This impulse comes from within. My goal as a parent is to raise kids that are self-confident and happy. And I don't care if they're geniuses or not, although I think they are. And I realize I just called them little geniuses. They're not so little anymore. They were little when I started this book.
Yeah.
But, I think most, when you talk to parents, most of us do think that our own kids are pretty smart. And
sure.
That's actually not so far from the truth. I mean, there's a lot of science out there that says that just about anybody is capable of expert-level performance in some domain, some subject. And it's a matter of matching your kids with the right thing and putting them in front of enough things and different sorts of activities and taking them places and novel experiences so that something eventually clicks.
The name of the book is The Boy Who Played with Fusion, Extreme Science, Extreme Parenting, and How to Make a Star. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Tom Kleins, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
That was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. Again, Tom Kleins is the author of The Boy Who Played with Fusion. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.